Moore was certainly current with the best Christian humanist scholarship, and he defended it against both scholasticism and obscurantism. This was very interesting. Like Collett, for example, he had come to feel that in certain respects scholasticism had run its course. And now was the time for the new learning. Now was the time for great works of scholarship. Now was the time for learning many languages. Now was the time for applying historical and philosophical and other tools to the study of problems at hand. So in those ways, he was hostile to the traditional scholasticism that still dominated the universities, at least of Northern Europe. But he was also very much opposed to the kind of obscurantism that could sometimes emerge. For instance, in his day, there was a very considerable controversy raging. It went right from England to Germany. It was going all over Northern Europe about the teaching of Hebrew. Now, there were certain numbers of people who said that we have perfectly good Bibles and they're translated into Latin and we don't need to fool around with them. And then some people would have said yes, but after all, you know, a good deal of that was in Greek in the first place. I said, well, all right, we can learn Greek. I said, well, you do have, of course, the Old Testament. It was once in Hebrew. People said, stop. That studying Hebrew and studying the scriptures in Hebrew was to Judaize. Well, Moore wrote a ringing defense of the liberal arts, of liberal study, and of the breadth of learning to the authorities at the University of Oxford when they had tried to stamp out the teaching of Hebrew. It is as beautiful and moving and powerful a defense of liberal studies as has ever been written. And it betrays that Renaissance conviction, that Italian Renaissance conviction, and that Northern Renaissance conviction, that study can only improve, that learning is always a good thing, that no failings can come through earnest and serious study. Well, as we know, alas, poor Moore broke with King Henry over the matter of his royal divorce and was eventually executed for refusing to compromise for many reasons, I suppose. But from Henry's point of view, of course, it simply wouldn't do that the Lord Chancellor of England, or the late Lord Chancellor of England, was opposing a policy as important as the royal divorce. So Moore was found guilty of treason and put to death. It has been said that Moore may have cultivated his own death by refusing to sort of make politic compromises, or at least to work behind the scenes in ways that might have got him off the hook. But maybe, indeed, his character was such that he was unwilling to make those kinds of compromises. Moore's great friend was Desiderius Erasmus. Born in 1469, he died in 1536. Desiderius Erasmus was the prince of humanists. We mentioned Michelangelo as someone who had become famous and rich in his own lifetime. Erasmus never became rich, but he certainly did become famous. Indeed, it's probably safe to say that no intellectual figure before Erasmus had ever had his kind of Europe-wide impact. And it's probably fair to say, by extension, that no one would again until Voltaire. Here was someone about whom, slowly but surely, everybody knew. Now, he himself came from relatively obscure origins. He is Desiderius Erasmus of Rotterdam. He's a Dutchman. He was educated in very modest schools and then educated by the Brethren of the Common Life. Remember, we talked about them in one of our lectures when we were sketching the background to the Renaissance. We saw that the official church was in some difficulty, but that there were certain lay movements, nevertheless, of considerable vitality. One of these that was particularly prominent in the Netherlands, the so-called Brethren of the Common Life, were groups of people who went about their ordinary daily preoccupations, but then also would live in proximity to one another, oftentimes would eat together on occasion, oftentimes would worship together, and sometimes study together as well. And sometimes in these brethren communities, there were at least some individuals who were quite learned. So, in a slightly odd place, among the Brethren of the Common Life, Erasmus first encountered humanism. Now, he became an Augustinian canon and was ordained a priest, but then he very shortly got permission to leave his monastery in order to study. For a number of years, he was an itinerant scholar. He lived for a while in Paris. He lived for a while in Louvain in Belgium. He lived for a while in Oxford. He lived for a while in Italy. He was taught by John Collett. He was influenced by the Italians. He was befriended by Thomas More. I mean, here was a person who built up from his late teens into his 30s an enormous array of connections right across Europe.